Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
I'm delighted to be here with Elisabeth Duval, who is a Spanish philosopher and writer who has studied in Paris. Now she's back in Madrid. She has various journalistic projects. She writes a column. She does a podcast. And she has, despite still being very young, already written four books, actually. Four. It's a tome of poems, two novels. Reina was one of them in 2020, and Madrid será la tumba, Madrid will be the tomb, in 2021. And also in 2021, her book Después de lo Trans came out in Spain, which is not yet translated into German, but will be, which is very good news. It will come out in the Wagenbach Verlag, I think, next year, probably. Now, the subject we need to talk about tonight is transgender. And this is, of course, a subject where there's a whole lot of fighting, a veritable querelle du transgender in the media and in the social media between activists, legislators, and really almost anyone right now. And a sort of a hot button issue of this day. And it's much more so nowadays than for a long time before. It's become an almost fetishized concern of conservatives. They fear the transgender bathroom almost as much as the devil fears the holy water. But it is also a culture war issue inside the progressive left. There are extremely violent fights between old school feminists, trans activists, and queer theorists about the status of trans. And we will, of course, I think, have to come to all of those things, I am sure, but I think we need to start a bit more with the philosophical basics, how to account for transgender within the framework of what we normally think of as gender theory in a more general sense, what feminist and queer theory has elaborated over the last 20, 30, 40 years, or even the last century, depending on where you start your sort of gender theory explorations. What are men, what are women, what are genders even in our society? What is the role of nature and nurture, of culture and biology? And what is trans within this whole framework? So maybe I'm just going to ask the really primitive question. What is trans and how does it relate to other concepts and other ideas of gender?
I think it's a really difficult question because in the first place, when I wrote the book, when I wrote Después de lo Trans, I dedicated the entirety of it to asking myself, what is trans? Can we really say that trans as a concept has a real stability to it, a real solidity to it? The way we talk about trans issues in the current time and place, are we really using it right, or are we using it in a way that makes sense? Are we using it as a concept that makes sense? And in the end, the answer is the concept we use to speak about trans issues is so large, it tends to regroup in this concept such a huge amount of individuals who have often nothing to do with each other and have so many differences inside of this group of trans people that often or sometimes there's more difference inside the very group of trans people than there are differences outside of it with other categories in the system of gender. So I come finally to a definition of what trans is, which is very basic, or I try to find the minimal, what we can say applies in every case, in the case of someone being trans, in the case of there being a trans person, which is to say to me and the book, the very last definition is that to be trans, the trans existence in itself constitutes a movement. And I don't speak of a political movement when I say movement. I speak of a certain dynamic that takes place inside of the spectrum of gender. I speak of a certain variation, a certain change that takes place in gender identity, where someone who was once located, who occupied the space in a very concrete aspect of gender, changes, moves in a certain way, and ends up in another side of the spectrum. There are so many different ways of talking about trans people, of considering the relationship to medicine, to hormones, to social transitions, to how they are known in society, to how they are intelligible in society, that it's really, really, really hard to come up with another difference. And I think sometimes when we talk about definitions such as a trans person is any person who doesn't agree with the gender they were assigned at birth, which is a definition I've heard a lot of times, I think there's an issue with this definition, which has a lot to do with how politically people who would not be considered trans and who in our use of current language and normal language, we would never speak of them as trans, but they do not have necessarily to be in accordance or agree with the roles that were imposed to them or the ways of behaving that were imposed to them. If you were to ask cisgender women how they feel about what society projects for them, they would not, a huge part of them, would not be in agreement with what the model or the ideal or the role of being a woman constitutes for them. And I think it's an issue to define transgender identity or to define what it is to be trans simply in terms of not being in agreement. Also, because it frames the trans issue as a kind of choice, or it frames the trans issue as a kind of something we partake in as if we were completely free and we had purely the freedom of choosing if we are in agreement or not, what we do about this agreement or not that we have about the identity that we have, how we want to present to the world, how we want the world to understand us. So I think the simplest, and by going by Occam's razor, almost the definition I've come to terms with is to be transgender, for there to be something that is trans in a gender identity, there has to be a movement in what we consider to be gender, and we'll have to define gender afterwards for the definition to be complete.
Yes, we should definitely do that. Could you talk a bit about how you understand and use the concept of gender, what you find to be the most useful definition of gender?
I think, and the way I do it in the book is to use an example of someone who has conceptualized gender without being tied to theorizing about trans issues. Judith Lorber, who's not suspicious of being particularly pro-trans, she has even some really harsh words for transgender people, but who uses gender as a tool for philosophical analysis, for theoretical analysis, and thinks it's valid to explain some phenomena in current society. Which I think it's interesting because it tells us that even if in the public debate or how we debate about things currently in the present time, there are some concepts that are thought of as if they were simply ideological weapons, they can have validity in philosophical analysis beyond how they are used to for the sparring, for the arguing between one part and the other. Judith Lorber distinguishes, and I think this distinction is something we can keep from her theory, or in rewarding her, I distinguish between gender as a system, as a process, and gender as an identity. She defines a long list of different factors, different things that have to be taken into account when we define gender. It's a really long list and it calls for a really long explanation, so I'm not going to explain every single one of those factors. But to very quickly and in a fast way define it, gender as a system is what we can theorize as the entirety of the norms, roles. She talks even about gender scripts that are assigned to women and to men as to how they have to behave in society in gendered ways, how there is a repetition of social roles, which is, and I do not deny it, I affirm it, even in a first instance, based purely upon biological sex. I think that's an interesting also part of the book, to talk about the origins of gender and the link in those origins between gender and sex, and a historical development in how those roles are divided, how gender finally as a social structure, as an institution, as a system, serves as a system of oppression against women, and then how, as it happens with so many other systems of oppression, from this system, from this process, from this structure, we go on to take one part of it as an identity that also constitutes us. When we talk, for example, about work, there's a huge part that's what comes from Marx's analysis, from work that we can theorize about and we can criticize. But finally, there's not only the fact that the division of labor divides us between those who work, those who are exploited, those who sell their workforce to those who take profit from them, but also beyond the mere fact that we are doing this activity, that we are partaking in this activity, there's also a part of it that constitutes our identity, how we identify, how we think of ourselves, how we behave in a society. The same thing and the same type of imaginary identification, which I talk about during the book, happens with gender and explains how gender not only functions as a system of social relationships, but also something we internalize, we take in, that's deeply ingrained into our heads, our brains, how we think about ourselves. I think it's really difficult to think about oneself without thinking about at least multiple dimensions of gender, and finally a part of identity that's really difficult to do without.
But if social norms of gender are so much part of our identity, our inner self, so to speak, can we still criticize them and try to change them? And how do we do that?
Yeah, you cannot self-identify with the social norms that are imposed with you if you disagree with those social norms. You cannot self-identify with the idea that women are more servile, that women are more submissive, that women are subject to only certain roles in society. If you want to change those, you have in a certain way to rebel against what society, I wouldn't say exactly imposes you, because I think in a certain way the relationship we have to gender as is a relationship we have to work is so much more complex than simply an imposition. Yeah. I think there's even a part of such impositions in which we take pleasure in being imposed such roles, but I think it's clear you have to disagree with it and you have to rebel against it, which also makes trans existence in a certain way paradoxical in relationship to those gender impositions. I establish in some other parts of the book that I don't think, and I tie it with the importance in recent years, particularly in Spain, that the movement of trans minors and transgender adolescents and children, teenagers and children, has had in Spain, in which I have been an active part back in the years 2014. I talk about it in saying that there are some transgender identities that can easily or perfectly be assimilated into our norm, be assimilated into an acceptable standard of what it is to be a man, to be a woman, even if it is a trans man or a trans woman. I think those can be assimilated. I think there may not be anything necessarily or inherently revolutionary about being transgender. And at the same time, talking about why it is paradoxical, this kind of trans existence, but we can extend it to any existence in gender in general. Evidently, I do not agree with the social impositions of what being a woman implies or what being a man implies, but I cannot fully distance myself from those social roles or those social impositions. I cannot do as if I had been constructed or created or as if I function socially without those impositions or without those roles.
So given this, that gender is so much a social category and not just a biological one, how does one in this framework, how do you account for in this framework for the coming into being of trans existence?
How I come to explain it is how this process in which gender as a system, as a structure, as a process comes onto us, or how we, in a certain sense, receive it, how we internalize it, how we construct and imagine ourselves from gender, how this interaction between the individual and the system or the process takes place. And I do it in talking about a mixed approach that would not be strictly cultural. It would not be saying all the factors that have a role in this process are cultural factors. It is not 100% socially constructed, but it is not necessarily or deterministically tied to biological factors or the theories of, for example, as have been used sometimes, a certain charge of androgens or estrogens in the mother's womb before a trans person is born that would make the brain of such a person develop a feminine personality, a masculine personality. And I do not do this because I think, for one part, that there can be biological factors that influence the reception of the schema, the script, the structure of gender, but the fact that gender is socially constructed and its roles constitute a structure that's historically determined make it so that this relationship is always more complicated or can be complexified much more than we thought. There are factors of the familiar history of an individual that can be taken into account when we try to explain why someone, and I think we cannot establish an universal criteria for why someone turns out to be transgender, why someone is trans. There are family factors, there are biological factors, there are cultural, societal, where they are born, the circumstances in which they are born, which influence how they construct their imaginary identity. And as such, it's a lot more complex than this case of Neoplatonism, where there would be this soul wandering the world and it would end up in a body it wasn't meant to be in.
Okay, so it's not Neoplatonism. That makes sense to me. So the way you describe trans identity in a social sense, as a social category as well, that also implies, I think, a historical dimension, no? Because, of course, gender relationships change over time. We can argue about if biology changes over time, but that's not the issue here. If social gender roles change, if the understanding of gender changes, maybe not as radically as some feminists would like them to and not as quickly, but still there is a development. We do not speak about men and women, about gender in general, the same way nowadays as we used to. What does that mean for trans identity? Does trans identity undergo a historical change? Or maybe to ask it in a more pointed way, is there such a thing as transgender identity throughout history? Or is it a specifically modern phenomenon?
Yeah, in the book, when I talk about this, I reference the debates not about the trans issue, but about LGBT in general, and concretely homosexual identities that are led by Halperin, for example, in historical theory, when there are debates about, in ancient Greece, can we say or that the people in ancient Greece, the men who had relationships with other men, were homosexuals, or is it another identity that we cannot conform to the way in the 21st century or the 20th century that we understand those relationships? We have, in a certain way, to take into account the social differences, the historical differences, everything that makes that society different, that makes the ways people have relationships with each other that involve sex, that involve gender, that are different from the ones we have now. And I think in this sense, sometimes from trans activist movements, there have been essays or a certain will to recover historical references or say this person from the 15th century was trans. I think there are some I even like or I find funny or amusing. For example, when people talk about if Jeanne d'Arc was trans, I find it amusing as an experiment, as an exercise. But at the same time, I think we cannot separate trans identity and what trans means to us and what trans really means from a medical practice that begins in the 20th century, and concretely a medical practice that begins partly in Germany and that's very tied to the Weimar Republic. That's tied to the first theoretical examinations of what Markus Risch calls transsexualismus and the first definition of what being trans can be. And the very first way of naming phenomena that may exist before it is named, that may have certain forms of existence where people are already transgressing the frontiers between gender and changing or moving in a certain way in the spectrum of gender. But until the moment it is in a certain sense tied to the medical industry, tied to a certain diagnosis, tied to a certain conception, I think it's really hard for us to conceptualize it as having much to do with what we consider to be trans in the current time. And this notion of, I dedicate one of the first parts of Después de lo Trans to exploring the different ways of conceptualizing trans identity, the ways of conceptualizing it as this kind of mix in different proportions. And it's the most progressive way of conceptualizing it at the moment, which is the European way of thinking about it, of the male and the female, and since someone who's born in their terms, in the terms of that time period and the medicine of that time period, someone who is born into a male body has a particular mix or proportion of male and female attributes, which also leads to this interesting notion, at least at the time, that every human being has a certain proportion of male and female attributes, which is never 100%, but which is a mixture of different factors, versus the version that comes mostly from the United States and also from some developments of psychoanalysis, which considers directly trans identities to be a kind of mental disorder for which the treatment or the cure in the terms of that time is medical, and they have to force people to stop being transgender.
I find this historical account you give fascinating. I think that we need to now move on to what is happening now, and maybe not yet to the political fights, but at least to the theoretical contentions. You already said that there are a lot of people, not just trans people, who do not agree with the assigned gender role that they are given by society, by societal norms. Now, the classical feminist answer to this problem, one could say in a very broad terms, is that we have to change society. Let's change a society that restricts us by gender stereotyping, by gender norms, that makes our freedom less so than it could be, because we all have to agree to very restricted gender roles. So let's subvert these clichés of masculinity and femininity. Is this a point where feminism and trans theory clash, where they have different goals?
I would hesitate to talk about trans theory. I think there have been very few developments of true trans theory. We can talk maybe at Sandy Stone or Susan Stryker or the writers, but I think there have been few developments of trans theory in general. And I would, in the book at least, I position myself in a certain sense closer to the first answer you give, closer to the classical feminist answer that you give. And I do this in a position to two things. The first of them is this kind of idea of an utopia that we would arrive in after an effort to multiply the gender categories and multiply the types of gender roles a different body can assume and the types of different ways of existing in the world someone of different genders can assume, and also in relationship to a certain way in which the debate in Spain has changed in the last few years. There has been a word which, not only in relationship to gender, but in relationship to many other debates in feminism, has become a kind of word used for absolutely everything as a political goal, but which doesn't really mean a lot, which is abolition. To abolish gender, to abolish, in the case of a recent debate in Spain, the abolition of prostitution or sex work, all the debates about abolition. I think the question of gender abolition, I compare it to the abolition of the state in Marxist thought, or how we think about the institution or the administration of things they will be after the administration of people in Marxist thought. We cannot forget that this is the least developed part of Marxist thought, precisely because imagining the future that comes afterwards, the critique of the current system, is the hardest part of it. And also in the case of gender, I think it's not only that it is difficult to imagine a future after gender, I would say it's almost impossible, or that it is far easier or far more necessary to imagine a society after capitalism than a society after gender. Why do I say such a thing? In the first place, gender as a system of social structure, even if it changes, even if it modifies itself through the course of history, if we take it really basically to mean the social relationships and structures and institutions that come from an initial division of labor after biological facts which explain sex and social institutions which have to do with a genderized approach to society, to think that the memory or the souvenir of such institutions and such relationships and the thousands of years of such institutions would potentially disappear if it were regulated by law. I completely agree with a position that says that social norms and social roles and the oppressive components of gender and what gender means in the current time and how we relate to gender needs to change, and we need to change it. But I would also contest this point, this part of traditional feminism that would defend a position relatively similar to mine, would say that trans people in a certain way reinforce the gender system. The fact, and I've said it before, that there can be assimilated or conservative trans existences in the current system does not mean that it is the fault of such a statistical minority to continue in the establishment of such a system.
That makes a lot of sense to me, but how then do we account for the fights between certain traditional feminists and trans activists?
It's really hard to find one single explanation to the entire affair. I think there are many, many factors we have to take into account. But it's also the fact that in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, all these things were already being debated in the United States. All the debates about transgender women or trans women or trans people in general and feminism were already taking place. And when we look at the text from Sandy Stone and Susan Stryker, they already reference those cases, they already reference those debates in terms that are not very far from the way we talk about them in the current present of ideas. When there are even moments where some of those feminists who, in a way that I find particularly curious, make this kind of mix between radical feminists from the 70s, they take Germaine Greer, they take Janice Raymond, but they also take a whole kind of mystic of femininity that has a lot more to do with the feminisme de la différence from France and naturalization of certain aspects of femininity lie to something a lot more biological. But instead of it being a new way of thinking or of debating about these issues, I think it's a retelling or it's a repetition of the same arguments and the same debates.
Yes, I guess history does have this tendency of repeating itself. And yet, why have debates that are so old, as you describe them, that have a long history, become so toxic in the present? I mean, it's not just trans activists and old school feminists who react extremely polemically to one another. I mean, there are also a lot of people on the progressive left, for instance, that are not only being wonderfully inclusive in accepting everybody's identities, but also quite liberal in the use of the word transphobe. More liberal than I am comfortable with, for example. Sometimes it almost seems as if a historical and social theorizing of what trans is, such as you propose it, is almost not wished for or allowed. Is there room for debate here? Or in other words, is our debate about these issues still functional? Or has it become completely dysfunctional?
The way we debate in the current time and place, the way we have discussions with one another, the way we tend not to listen or try not to find, be it small as it may, the little grain of truth that there may be in our theoretical adversary or opponent's argument, the way we ignore that, and if our opponent is defending something, radically consider that just by the fact it's being defended by this one concrete person, thinking about it is almost prohibited. I think it's making our sphere of debate something much worse than it was. At the same time, it's making our sphere of debate something much larger and something which anyone can now partake in in a way that's much freer than ever before, and in a way that sometimes resembles this kind of echo chamber where everyone's screaming at each other without anyone actually trying to listen or anyone actually trying to have a debate. And I think at the times when I've had the opportunity to talk with people face to face and not through those highly aggressive ways of communication that can be social media, the answer and the result has been much more positive than what I have found in other ways. I think this debate continues to be possible, maybe not in social media, maybe not on Twitter, where any kind of position or any kind of complexification is impossible. I would not frame it as a war, but it is true that when I said or when I argued that to understand social phenomena in a way that's more complex, in a way that takes into account how things are functioning in the current moment, I found a lot of resistance, and I found a lot of resistance from trans people and activists in Spain who I know and who I appreciate. And I understand the place they're coming from. I understand how, in a certain sense, it hurts to have your own identity theorized about. It hurts to have your identity put into question, mostly after a time in which month after month you have had to live, not people in a serious and compassionate way talking about identity and theory and everything, but people week after week putting your identity into question in really aggressive and really violent ways, which has been the case for some of them. And I think even if there's always a certain danger to theorizing, and I think theorizing would not be as great of an activity as it is if there were not a certain danger to putting things into question and not taking things for granted, it is an activity we have to do, nevertheless.
I like the thought that philosophy has to be dangerous to be useful. It is, of course, useful to think things through, can also help us allay fears. And there are a lot of fears surrounding trans. There is a higher visibility of trans people. There are probably more of them these days because the option is now more broadly available. And we are debating or already implementing changes in the laws and in society. And a large part of the reaction to that is negative, fearful. For example, there seem to be a lot of parents who are afraid that if we as a society normalize and accept transgender existence, then there will be teenagers or even children who would feel encouraged to think of themselves as trans, even if they are not necessarily so, just because they are young and confused and don't know what to do with themselves and their bodies.
I think a lot of the times when we are having these debates, or in Spain, when we've had those debates, precisely because it was so violent, I speak in a fake plural. I speak in a fake first person of the plural. But in general, in taking into account the fact that not all those people who criticize the trans law, or not all those people who held critical positions against, sometimes even against trans people, did it from a position of evil or a position of hatred or a position of irrational madness. But I think also in trying to convince people in general, in trying to articulate any progressive vision of society or anything that makes us go forward, we have to take into account those fears and we have to answer to those fears. We cannot do as if those fears, even if afterwards we can criticize them theoretically all we want, as if those people were not in a certain sense legitimate to fear. And if we did not have to reply, we did not have to offer a certain sense of comfort, we did not have to offer a certain way out of this position of fear, of vulnerability in which they are in. And I think in the case of what we really are talking about, for example, in the case of the trans law reform in Spain, lots of times the fears we hear about or what they are talking about have little, if not nothing, to do with what the law is set to put into place. For example, in Spain, in the last year, what the law did fundamentally was make it easier for people, mostly after 16, to change the name and what it says in the document of identity, if they are male or female. That's what it did. The law in Spain in 2021 had nothing to do with access to surgery, had nothing to do with access to medicine, because all those factors were already regulated, and in some communities were already regulated since more than 10 years ago, without any kind of transgender craze or trans epidemic taking over the medical systems, or without there ever being the possibility of someone undergoing a medical treatment without there being a certain supervision by an endocrinologist, by qualified professionals who would assist such a person in a journey. The image that's been created, and I think parents are right to fear such an image, is that the world we were creating would be a world in which we'd go to the counter and order hormones being 12, and they would give you the hormones freely, and you would access them, and the day afterwards you would begin your treatment without any supervision, without any control, without any kind of test. It's an image that can provoke fear, because it's evident that parents would have fear of such a thing going so out of control, even if a law did not regulate.
I think the fact that you speak with so much empathy about the fears that people have developed towards trans is quite remarkable, especially in these times where it seems to me, at least, that much less people on the progressive side are invested in the slow and laborious work of persuasion, and much many more are engaged in the fast and censorious work of intimidation.
I think, in fact, it's not a symptom of the trans issue in general, but just of the way public discussion in general is conducted. Like, I think in the left, in general at this moment, there are few people trying to do the slow persuasion over the long term, and a lot of people doing the intimidation. And that's not just a phenomenon of the left, that's a phenomenon in general of
that would be
our public discussion has been articulated, how it's taken place in the current moment, how we listen to each other, or how social media and those platforms make us not listen to each other or make the discussion take place. And I think it is a symptom of how we debate in the current time and place, how the debate is taking place in our current societies. And I think if we want to fix that, it's not so much going to the specifics of each debate, on the debate on race, on the debate on gender, on the debate on a lot of different issues, but thinking about how we are engaging in debate in general, and maybe the topic or the subject of our debate should be debate in itself.
I get that point, and I think you're absolutely right, and yet it does also matter what we're talking about, because there are, I think, racism or trans activism are two of these sort of
issues.
They
touch into identities and they touch into very personal questions, which
exactly.
make the aggressivity that can come out be a lot greater. And in any debate where there's a component of personal hurt, in a recent article I wrote for Publico, I had one sentence, one phrase, which was also kind of there to spark a certain polemic. And I was thinking about when Wendy Brown talking in the 90s about neoliberalism and the left and identity politics takes this term from Nietzsche talking about ressentiment, the politics of resentment. And I said in this article that the cultural politics in this moment, and particularly, but I think not only, I think it's also present in the right wing, the cultural politics of the left in this moment are politics of resentment.